Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Reddy, and I'm joined by Matt Two Rumpets. Matt, thanks for joining me again on this fine lockdown evening slash afternoon slash morning for our tri-continental podcast today.
I know, tri-continental. It's amazing. You know, I saw you Thursday for Remain Indoors. I saw you Friday for iRacing.
Oh, yeah.
And somehow a morning of trigonometry with my daughter, and it seems like at least a week and a half since we last spoke.
That's the thing with kids. They're terrible and their time sucks and time never seems to pass. I, too, have been doing much less complicated mathematics with my children, but have been equally perplexed and frustrated and saddened by fractions and remembering what the top one does and what the bottom one does and how to add them together and such like.
We had fractions in the denominator today and radians at the same time. It was the worst.
Enough of this nonsense. You can join us for the Remain Indoors podcast on Monday at 2 p.m. UK time for stuff like that. Now is the time for F1 stuff. And we can tell you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute or a news show before your Monday morning walk to the shed. Or you can listen over breakfast. Look, the rules are off. Listen when you want. We might be wrong, but we're first. We're also joined by journalist, PR man, and all-round knower of things, Chris Stevens. How's it going, Chris?
It's going great, Spanners. It feels like so long since I've been on the show, but in the time away that I've had, I've been super busy, as viewers of the live stream will see.
Right, Chris has got himself, finally, a steering wheel at home that you've clamped to your desk, and you've been setting about doing some laps of the Nordschleife today, turning a wheel on, I can't remember what game it was.
GT Sport.
GT Sport, which is not iRacing. Is that like more of a gamey game? Is it on an Amiga 64?
No, it is considered more of a sim. I don't know how much of a sim, not compared to iRacing, but it runs for the PS4. And so I just wanted to run some laps on the Nordschleife that I didn't have to pay for.
But you're doing what I always tell people in the panel to do and listeners out there. For goodness sake, if you're going to be a motorsport fan, go and turn a wheel. And you've got yourself a relatively inexpensive wheel. It was a Logitech G29.
Yes, it was.
And you've been able to turn some laps and have some fun relatively cheaply.
Yeah. No, it's all really good, actually. And a lot of these sim games on PS4 are going like cheap as chips at the moment as well. So good time to invest.
Fantastic. And joining us from the other side of the world, it's our video producer who creates the lovely graphics in the shed and all the glorious iRacing action from Friday night. It's Steve Amy. G'day, Steve.
G'day, Spanners. Welcome from down under. It's early in the morning down here, but looking forward to a wonderful sunny day.
Now, I normally, like, when you say, I had to wake up at like 3 o'clock to do the show, and you did today, you woke up at 3 a.m. to come and join us on the podcast, so thank you. Normally, if that was a normal human, I would feel sympathy. For some reason, when it's an Aussie, I'm like, good. I'm glad you had to get up at 3 a.m.
Oh, you're just hemispherist is what you are. You don't like anybody who is upside down.
Don't pretend that you weren't just finishing off a barbecue from the day before, and then all you did was just roll from the Barbie to your desk and then start podcasting with us.
Oh, I wish that were true. No, I woke up in anticipation of doing this wonderful live stream.
Amazing. So that's our panel today. It's Matt Trumpet, Chris Stevens, and Steve Amy. Now, Chris Stevens later on is going to talk to us about some of the realities of being a motorsport journalist on the road and some of the mechanics of journalism. Chris Stevens, of course, a graduate of the Autosport Academy program. And Steve Amy is not a hobbyist video producer in any way, shape, or form. He is a professional video man. And we've got a bunch of questions from our Slack group and Twitter. And we're going to have a general discussion about F1 broadcasting. Now, we'll forgo the big dirty news bumper, as this morning the F1 world woke up to the sad news that F1 legend Sir Stirling Moss had passed away at the age of 90. A big personality was Sir Stirling Moss within our sport, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend to you that I understood completely his era or that I have an encyclopedic knowledge of his time and his effect on motorsport at the time. But what I can tell you is I know full well the effect that he's had on the generation above me. So seeing Martin Brundle warmly tweet about someone who had walked him through his early days in motorsport, and also thinking back to the documentary he did with Lewis Hamilton, driving side by side in their Mercedes across the banking, in the old banking in Monza, and seeing the awe with which Lewis Hamilton held him. And then also seeing them in those vehicles that looked like rocket ships on wheels, making you realize that these guys were truly pioneers. You go, these guys, they were real, real daredevils. You know, it's from a period where you really can't compare with the modern drivers, and you can't put the modern drivers in that situation because you don't know which ones of the modern drivers would be up for it. But without doubt, Sir Stirling Moss has made a massive impression on F1, Matt. Certainly from a British point of view, we hold him in a certain regard. How was he seen over in the US?
It's funny, you know, you mentioned Martin Brundle having that impact, like helping you to understand the place that he holds in the history, not just of Formula One, but all of motorsport. For me, it was Mario Andretti. That was the guy I watched when I was a kid. I saw him in IndyCar. I saw him in Formula One in the early 70s. And his tweet was, "This guy was my hero."
Yeah.
So that's the generation we're talking, post-World War II. And just as I am fond of doing, I'm trying to bring just a couple of numbers to help people sort it out. Across all of his races, he was 212 out of 529 in victories, including the 1955 Mille Miglia, which was a 1,000-mile, 10-hour race held across a single day. And his Formula One career started, I believe, in 1951, but he really came to the fore in 1955 when he raced with Mercedes and Fangio. And I think, Chris, you have something you'd like to add to that?
Well, I think the reason that he is considered a legend of motorsport, not just because of the success he had in Formula One, but the success he had outside of the World Championship, especially because this is back in the days when non-championship events were still a thing. And as you mentioned, the vast majority of different things he took his hand to, sports car racing, rallying, saloon car racing, that he was successful in every single area.
Now, Steve, you watched Sir Stirling Moss on his debut. How did you find the action back then? Obviously, Steve, you are a generation, a step ahead of my good self. You know, how did his effect on Formula One translate in Australia?
Okay, that's a little difficult for me to say, really, because I'm a latecomer to car racing. I didn't get involved in car racing until I was like 22 or 23, and that's when I fell in love with it. But during the 60s and early 70s, there were two racing car drivers that I did hear of. One was Jack Brabham, obviously, because he was an Australian and a local hero. But the other driver, and the only other driver that I heard of during the 60s, was about Stirling Moss. And he was renowned in those days, not only for being a fast and hard and fair racer, but he raced in all sorts of categories. He wasn't just a Formula One racer. He did sports cars. He did the Mille Miglia a few times. And in fact, the book written by his then navigator, Jenkinson, is a great read about how this young, you know, man in the 60s had drove the 1,000 miles in 10 hours. You know, his average speed, and you've got to remember the Mille Miglia is driven along rough coastal roads through villages and he did it in 10 hours. He was a legend in that time. So, yes, he was the only other driver that I'd ever heard of, during the 60s.
And a lot of people will label him as the greatest Formula One driver not to win the world championship. But all these things that we've just been listing, he is so much more than that. And I think, you know, the reason that he's so highly regarded in this country, in Britain, is because, you know, he was the big British athlete in motor racing at the time. And if he didn't have the unfortunate circumstance of being teammates with Juan Manuel Fangio, then he would have won 2 or 3 titles.
In fact, I believe he finished runner-up to Fangio 3 times out of the 4 he was second. And when you talk about how important he was to British racing, it's hard to overstate that. Once Mercedes withdrew from racing, he went on to exclusively race British cars, Van Wals, Coopers, BRMs, and particularly Lotus. Notably, in Argentina in 58, he won the first race ever won by a mid-engined Formula One car, which is where the design ultimately wound up going for everyone. That was for Rob Walker. His 61 wins in Monaco in the Lotus 18, which is the previous year's car, and again at the Nürburgring against the shark nose of Ferrari, also are two legendary races that people talk about. But if it comes to me and comes to Moss, the other way he's made the hugest impact has to be his sportsmanship, in particular defending Mike Hawthorn when he would have won the championship had he not. Hawthorn spun. He was accused of putting his car in reverse. Moss came out and said no, he was steering downhill to bump start the car. Without those points, Hawthorn doesn't win the championship, Moss does. Moss could not let it lie. He went to the stewards without being asked and defended him. So this is why people talked about him up until this day and why he's so important for our sport.
And maybe just as a note to maybe some of our younger viewers who don't know about what Formula One was like back in the 50s. Obviously, we all know it was a very dangerous time. But, you know, of course, it was an era where teams would bring more than 2 cars to races. Obviously, it's now in the regulations, it has to be 2 cars. But Mercedes had 4 or 5 back then when Fangio and Moss were driving for them. So, and some people can always kind of assume that, oh, well, he was the second best Mercedes, therefore that's nothing special, but he was the best of, you know, 5.
Thanks very much for that, guys. And looking at the chat room, there's comments from Corolla, best driver not to win the championship, and an outpouring of grief and appreciation for an F1 character. And I think it's not controversial to say an F1, certainly a British F1 legend. Thank you to everybody in the live chat room. You can join them by going to YouTube, searching for Missed Apex Podcast. You can join our live chat as we're talking, as Kadenath has, Anders, Nothkey, DJ, Jimmy, and Michael so far in the chat room, Christopher and Anders and John and Othnell. Welcome to the chat room. Go and subscribe to us on YouTube. We're at nearly 8,000 subscribers, and that would be a lovely target to hit during the lockdown. It's time for a bit more Big Dirty News, though.
Big Dirty News.
Well, there has been a lot of news because everybody kind of just battened down the hatches, went, all right, what's going on here? Is the first race going to be Europe? Are we just going to the European races? Oh, no. And now we're kind of settled into this. Let's not think about it for a while. Let's manage the lockdown. Let's see how we can survive. And then, of course, Canada has officially been cancelled, something we talked about with Matthew Carter last Sunday, and something we've got a bit more news on as well. But now, Matt, we're seeing the real responses to the teams, as it's no longer a case of we're skipping a few races and then we'll see you all in, smoke me a kipper and I'll see you at Paul Ricard. They're actually having to now go, ooh, we need to survive. We need to survive through all of this. And I think we went through last week which teams we thought were in trouble. And I think Williams is going to be the top of every list. 2 years ago, they struggled to get to testing, claimed it wasn't about money in any way, shape or form, something which precisely 17 people worldwide believed, and their money issues have been well publicized. So not surprising to see that they're the first team to make a real big, drastic, bold move to survive.
Yeah, and this apparently, according to Claire Williams, was underway as far back as December of 19 in terms of they sold at Williams Advanced Engineering very clearly, regardless of what they said about money. The team, the Formula One team itself, was in dire straits. So they sold Advanced Engineering and they made a commercial deal with Latifi's dad, who Latris Racing is the actual entity that the deal is made with. And they borrowed money from him. They got a loan. And they've put up, amongst other things, their entire collection of Formula One cars throughout their whole history. Ooh. But that's not all. They've gone ahead and mortgaged the land their factory is built on and the buildings and the equipment in their factory as well in order to properly capitalize and participate in Formula One. And this was all done sort of before, I think, to a large extent, this crisis hit. So it's not a surprise to see that their workers are furloughed. And as at Haas and at Renault and at McLaren, the junior workers are furloughed and collecting 80% of their pay from the UK government, which is a very nice thing that the government does. And the senior staff are continuing to work, but with pay cuts. And that's kind of where we are right now.
Steve, what have you done? Steve, why are you in Chris's old bedroom?
Well, you know, money's tight at the moment, you know, with this pandemic. And I saw this cheap room come on the market. And so I took it. And unfortunately, the previous owner has left it in a god-awful mess. But it's cheap and it's cheerful.
Okay, so for those on the audio, okay, Chris has haunted me for the last 3 years with the background of his bedroom and of a cabinet that he refused to tidy and a wonky bookshelf. He's finally got rid of it. And by the way, yes, chat room, he is taunting me with his background of the Monaco pit lane. Boo, you're doing that just to hurt me. But Steve has now replaced his green screen from his Aussie background that he had to Chris's bedroom. How do you even do that? How do you make that magic happen?
It's called a button in Zoom. You press the... just press the right button. I have a question for Matt about Williams. Given that Williams is a publicly traded company these days, what's happened to the share price?
I've not been tracking the share price, but in general, shares have lost 30 to 50% of their value. I mean, I know Liberty's price has tanked, and I don't expect that to recover anytime soon because how do you price value back into a sport that's not happening? And the things that Williams had that made money, the MGUK, their Advanced Engineering, have now been sold off. So the good news is they're capitalized. They're sitting on a lot of cash. This is probably a good time to have been sitting on a lot of cash. But the question is, what is their burn rate going to be versus when the sport starts back up? And can they find the sponsors to keep themselves going? Because they're running out of, limbs to saw off to keep themselves in business, so to speak.
It definitely feels a little bit like you've sold Mayfair, you've sold hotels on Mayfair and Park Lane. That's not going to translate internationally, is it? Everyone's got different monopoly squares. Seems like they've sold hotels off the purple ones to keep the brown ones going, Old Kent Road in the UK monopoly set. what concerns me here is they seem to have really sold their future almost. So it's a desperate move to put your only money making, and I don't know if I'm guessing there a little bit, but advanced engineering was making money, but not costing money, which I'm assuming the F1 outfit was losing money. So if they've lost that revenue generation, are they just completely now in the hands of Lotus Racing, the Latifi's father's company, to be funded? So if Latifi goes away, is that the end of, or they have to latch onto another billionaire? This just seems desperate. This is horrible as a Williams fan.
Well, it's structured as a loan. So that means that as long as they make payments, they will be okay to continue. But what it means is they have to be able to run at least revenue neutral, I think would be the correct term. I'm not really a business person because I play the instrument with the three buttons, if you know what I mean. But my understanding is if they can keep the money coming in the door and going out roughly the same, they should be okay to continue. If they can't, then Latifi is in a position where he will be able to claim assets and or possibly control of the business. And then we would have Team Latifi versus Team Stroll.
Okay, look, let's be clear on the timelines, because you're saying that this was apparently all before the recent troubles. I mean, I didn't hear anything about that, which, you know, I'm not very observant, so that doesn't necessarily mean anything. However, the timing does look bad. Are we sure that this is not a linked thing, that they were always going to be in trouble in 2020, or is it the loss of revenue hastening things?
The loss of revenue to me would complicate things, according to the article that I read in
the internet
Autosport. It was a discussion that started in December 19, according to Claire Williams.
Yeah. And now, Chris, I mean, I don't want to be unkind to Williams. In fact, Steve, I don't want to be unkind to Williams, but when they were clearly running out of money in 2018 at the beginning of that season, they were going, no, nothing to see here. Well, it obviously was. So I hope that, you know, I'm not opening us up to litigation here, but I don't think that Williams necessarily, I think they maybe downplay the financial issues they have.
I think that goes without saying. They've been in dire financial straits for a few years now. And I don't think that, as much as, you know, I respect Claire for the job she's trying to do, I don't think that she has the wherewithal to be able to manage the organization out of the situation it's in. And they need some smart financial people in there to make it work. My other question is, with the Latifi involvement now in Formula One, fairly heavy, and remember that he also owns a part of McLaren, is this, you know, representative of a Canadian takeover of the whole business?
Yes, good point, actually, isn't it? What are they doing in Canada? Is there the billionaires club, or their private schools have like karting tracks in there or something? So they're all growing up, all these Canadian billionaires wanting to take over Formula One, Chris?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, obviously, Latifi and Stroll Jr. were coming through the ranks at roughly the same sort of time, despite, actually, in motorsport terms, there's quite a big age gap between them, I think, maybe 4 years. So they would have raced together a little bit, but not so much, especially when Stroll kind of jumped up from F3. While Latifi spent a few years in GP2, F2. But I would not be surprised if there was a rivalry between two of Canada's most wealthy families.
I don't know, Matt. I mean, we're going to go down the list in a little while of the teams that are in a little bit of trouble, ripe for the taking, as Matthew Carter said last week. You know, he was saying, you know, not only Williams, but he reckoned Gene Haas would accept an offer if somebody was to come in and take one. Are there more Canadian billionaire children around the corner? Like, what's Haas going to be called this time next year?
Probably Haas, because who would buy it? Why would you, I mean, like, what price would he, well, he at least has a capitalization to take the team back racing when racing happens again. I don't know. Like, who would invest in a Formula One team? Maybe Ross from Miami, who wanted a race. Maybe he'll buy a team instead. Possibly.
So speaking of Matthew Carter, just a reminder. No, it's not a reminder. It's an announcement, isn't it? Okay, so Matthew Carter suggested he would come on to Missed Apex podcast with Joe Sayward. And I think a lot of people who have been listeners to Mist Apex for some time would consider that a dream meeting of minds. And I always wondered how it would work. And I don't know why I have not pulled the trigger earlier, but I've asked both parties involved and they're both up for coming and speaking together in the shed with me and Matt next Sunday, which is April the something something, I don't know, like 19th, something like that. It's next Sunday anyway. So they'll be here in the shed, and they have spoken together publicly once at one of the audiences with Joe, because Joe does these audiences before Grand Prix, invites you to sit there, ask questions. Joe gets through 17 bottles of wine and answers your questions at length. It's a great time. One time, Matthew Carter was in the audience and Joe spotted him and said, "Well, you come up here as well, Mr. Carter." And it went on for significantly longer than it was supposed to. So that's one not to miss next week. For those of you who are fans of an audience with Joe, we are doing a virtual audience with Joe. And it is a Joe Sayward production. It is simply being produced out of the offices of Mist Apex Podcast. And by offices, I mean this shed and me. So I'm just helping Joe put these live audiences together. We're going to keep them as close as we can to the live audience experience, all over Zoom conferencing, which people are getting more and more familiar with now. The first one is on Tuesday, and we've kept it small so that I can make all the mistakes. And that is sold out now. We sold 20 seats for that. Loads of interest. We're going to open it up to a much bigger audience next time. So look out here and on Joe's publications for the next virtual audience with Joe.
I was just going to say longer than supposed to. That's kind of like a specialty of ours by now, isn't it?
No, that's a specialty of yours, Matt. I have a very strict limit for all the shows we do. I say 60 minutes, Mist Apex Podcast, 60 minutes. Listeners, when was the last time your podcast player downloaded a show under 60 minutes? I don't think it's ever happened. Remain Indoors, 45 minutes. And it's all you. We shouldn't assign blame, but it's definitely all your fault.
Exactly.
And there's a suggestion from Pete Jenkins that we should call it Diaries of an F1 Uncle, the Joe Sayward and Matthew Carter Show. Deal. Let's definitely call it that. I mean, Matt, we could go through the list of the F1 teams that are in trouble. I mean, they're all doing much the same thing. Haas, Renault, McLaren, those kind of suspects. They're basically going into their hibernation, for want of a better word.
Yeah, and Renault as well, where it's being discussed as and Racing Point. So pretty much every team, I don't know about Mercedes, Ferrari, I think, to a certain extent. Red Bull, I'm not sure about, but the smaller teams up to and including Renault all definitively have furloughed the staff. They call it enforced absence. And at Renault, interestingly enough, it's not just Enstone, it's Viry as well, where they make the engines. They've gone to a part-time schedule and they're rotating staff. I think partly that's just due to space restrictions, trying to keep people safe, but also because they're not selling engines. Like, nobody's doing anything, right? Everything is just kind of paused. So it's definitely tough times. And I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, Zach Brown was saying that if F1 doesn't handle this crisis correctly, they could lose up to four teams from the grid. Now, a little bit of me wants to say that's like saying, well, if I don't make the first turn, then I won't finish the race. But it is a time of high peril for Formula One, and I think for a lot of sport as well.
Steve, just before I go to your follow-up, just to answer the chat room there. Sorry, DJ, I forgot to say, no, the virtual audiences with Steve are not streamed on YouTube. You'll only get access to it if you are part of the Zoom call. So you buy your ticket for the Zoom call, and then that's it. You're locked in a private call with Uncle Joe. Speaking of F1 uncles, Uncle Steve.
I was just going to make a comment about Renault. Matt, you said that, they're not selling any engines, so that, you know, there's no income from all of that. My comment is they'd better get used to it, because from next year they don't have any customer teams anyway, so they're not going to be selling any engines to anybody. So maybe now they should be, you know, streamlining their very engine center to be, you know, more efficient for themselves only.
You may indeed have a point there, but I could easily see them selling engines again And a lot of that staff is also involved in, I would imagine, development, which the engine manufacturers were negotiating with the FIA to have their own set of regulations to help hold costs down even before this happened.
Who do you see them selling engines to?
Williams, Haas, if they have a break with Ferrari. I mean, there are teams out there that need engines.
Well, sure, but they're all contracted to, yeah, you know, the large manufacturers who make better engines than Renault, really.
I have to say, I'm with Steve there. Which team in their right mind, unless they really had their hand forced, would want to go to Renault? So we've seen their one customer team turn tail and run. And frankly, in the whole, I'm going to say it, everyone drink, turbo hybrid era, Renault, frankly, their reputation has been dragged through the dirt, only mildly saved by Honda coming in, but now Honda seem to have the jump on them as well. But they were dumped by Red Bull, dumped by Toro Rosso, dumped by McLaren. This is a one-way trip, Matt. No one is now going to go, do you know what? Really turn our season around, an underpowered Renault F1 engine.
Hey, Williams, would you like to get engines for half the price you're paying to Mercedes and have more freedom as a result?
Oh, okay.
So I don't know. I mean, they could sell it if they wanted to.
If you're going to make excellent points, I'm going to go to the other old grumpy person, Steve.
Well, I guess if they're going to sell it at half the price and they're going to make a loss, for their engine development, particularly if they've only got one team, then perhaps they could sell on to another team. But since all F1, teams are in the game to win, it seems kind of weird for them, for other teams to take a step back and say, we'll take an engine that isn't as good. It would only be forced by economic situation, I guess. And I guess Williams are close to that. So maybe you are right.
It's happened before. Renault has supplied them before. And I will point out that what's in it for Renault is going to be the data from the extra cars. It's tremendously useful to them. So, it doesn't look like a good choice right now, but it could absolutely happen in the future.
Oh, I don't know. I think Williams becoming Williams Renault again, which, by the way, reminds me of, an F1 replay we watched, which I'll get to later. I don't think it's going to be the same. I don't think we're going to have the glory days. I think that would be a sign of almost complete capitulation. And I think for some time, if we just circle back to Williams, they have really now become completely dependent on wealthy individuals keeping them afloat. And they are making decisions that are helping in the short term. And each short term decision they have made has put them further down this terrible road that they found themselves on. So, going to Stroll partly, I mean, that robs you of a development driver, that robs you of crucial data when you essentially only had one driver giving you useful input. You throw Sorokin in there as well. You now have a race team where a completely demotivated engineering force, yes, they're being paid by the investment from those two drivers and those two drivers' sponsors and families, but they're doing work that isn't being reflected on the track. And they go downhill and they take another downhill step. The same with Kubica's money, and now they seem completely dependent on the Latifi cash, and they're cutting off their arms and their ability to make any money and make any progression. The sadder we say the state of Williams F1 is, the more they seem to find another depth to sink to and another irreversible move backwards. So I think this could be the killer move, Matt, actually getting rid of a revenue generator, getting a loan from your driver. You're paying back your driver. That's not your employee anymore. That's not your driver anymore. They own the house. That's now your bank. They're now your owners. So Williams trying to race as an F1 entity when they're essentially beholden to their driver and they have to pay loan payment, a mortgage essentially on their business back to their driver, means that Williams is effectively dead as a racing entity.
They're effectively dead if and only if they cannot begin to turn it around and attract sponsors. Where they are now is, as I have said, I think they are capitalized to run through this year, to have run through this year. So they will have been saving some money that they're not spending building cars and going to races. And if they can attract the sponsors, if they can keep the revenue fairly neutral and make their loan payments, then they will continue to do so in 21. But it's a big bet, but they're all in it for the racing.
What they really ought to do in terms of getting sponsors is try and hit an untapped market. You know, there are a lot of people from the same industries that sponsor Formula One teams. They need to go and find one that say, hey, look, this industry is not in Formula One. It should be. And you can slap your name all over our car. I mean, they've already got a title sponsorship deal with Rocket, and that is entirely independent of Latifi. IT has a fairly big role in Formula One. Good start. They need to go and find other, like what Haas did with Rich Energy, finding like a rival to Red Bull. Now, before it all unfolded the way it did, on paper, it was a great idea.
I mean, even Williams turned down Rich Energy, to be fair, Chris. Even they could see that coming.
Just an example. Just an example. Like, find a rival to someone.
Okay, so who's a big sponsor for another team then that we can find a rival for? So they need to find a rival oil company. They need to find their own Petronas and Rocket ship themselves. Oh, Rocket.
But the problem with that is that because oil brands are associated with certain manufacturers, and so they, as a Mercedes customer, could not get like a Petronas rival sponsor, for example, or it would be very deeply frowned upon. So that's why it's important to try and find an untapped market where there's no, you know, politics already instilled.
Just speaking from here in the States, drugstores and banks would be like your main players if you're looking for lots of money.
But banks, they've already got Royal Bank of Canada on the car because of Latifi. So
Wait. Does he own a bank?
No, they're just a sponsor.
Oh, right. Okay. In my head, you said Royal Bank of Latifi. You didn't say that at all, did you? You said, well, that's just how I'm thinking about it. So let me know what you think of my comments. I'm speaking from the heart, and I'm speaking from what I've seen as this decline. We kind of called it, as soon as Stroll went there, and especially then when Sorokin went there, you know, me and Matt argued long and hard about the direction this could go. I was saying to Matt, you know, this could only go in one direction. Matt has always been a little more hopeful. I've seen the role of the pay drivers as far more detrimental in the long term in this era of Formula One than Matt. So we'll see in the next 2 years whether Matt's sense of optimism, you know, can play out. But let me know if you think I was being hyperbolic. I don't really know words, but I like the sound of that word. I'm going to go with it as if it's correct. If you think I'm being hyperbolic, you can email me, spannersready@gmail.com. Let me know what we're hyperbolic.
Just a kind of closing thought on the sponsors issue is that because a lot of companies are like turning away from Formula One in general and trying to move towards series that use hybrid or electric cars like Formula E, for example. So you'll notice that Shell have like really moved their attention away from the gas guzzling Formula One cars over to the e-fluids they make for electric vehicles, for example. So even like things associated with cars and the automotive industry in general is not becoming a no-go area, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to find people who want to be plastered on a Formula One car.
And if we go to the chat room, Lefty Guitar has reminded me that you can contribute to the show in YouTube with Super Chat. $1.99 Lefty has dumped in there and said, is the F1 business model as a whole exposed? Thank you for the contribution and the question, Lefty Guitar. That is probably a question we can definitely cover with Matthew Carter and Joe Saywood, Matt. So we'll park that for just a second.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
And we'll finish off our big dirty news by going to the top of the grid. And I nearly choked on my breakfast, right, this morning, guys, when I was reading my publication of racer.com. I know everyone else reads it on their website, but I get it delivered in a broadsheet. So as I was turning and folding over the pages of racer.com newspaper, because it's still 1998, I read in there that, you know, with the budget caps that we were saying, we were suggesting Matt might have to be a lot harsher in order for other teams to survive. That has been echoed by Zach Brown. Pretty sure he heard it on here and then said it in the media that, you know, a really harsh budget cap is going to be the only way to save all the teams and to stop them from going under and to make it competitive. And F1's really going to have to rethink the motorhomes, the constant tweaks of aero that Matthew Carter described as he went around the Renault offices and seeing a huge gaggle of aero engineers all picking up 35 grand a year wages just to get that marginal gain. So this budget cap, you know, is going to have to cut all of that out, simplify F1. And obviously you'll need agreement from all the teams. And one of the teams is Ferrari, who hilariously, in the funniest thing I've ever read, that's not true, but the funniest thing I've read today, Mattia Binotto believes the solution could be different F1 caps for different teams. Chris, I honestly, I couldn't believe the, like, do they have any self-awareness at all when they say things at Ferrari and then everybody applauds and then they say them out loud? The suggestion that you could have, it's terrible, this F1, isn't it? Because Ferrari spend 200 million and other teams spend 120 million. So let's have a budget cap that applies to everyone except Ferrari and presumably Mercedes. I couldn't believe what I was reading.
I know, it's like a bad joke, isn't it? Because it just defeats the purpose of the whole idea. And coming in as a manufacturer, making your own parts, that's the route you want to take. You could buy from someone else if you don't want to. If your budget does not allow for that, go and buy it. You know, if it were cheaper to make it, then everyone would be doing it.
Well, that's true, but they're being greedy little buggers anyway, because they get more money than anybody else from their, you know, having been in Formula One longer than anybody else, or that's the claim. So they're already getting more than anybody else. Now they want a bigger budget cap. For goodness sake, guys, if you can't manufacture your car for the same money as everybody else, then do what you've been saying for years and pull out of Formula One.
Steve, like, you've hit the nail on what? What I thought you'd finish that sentence with was, if you can't manufacture your parts cheaper per point of performance, then you're not doing as well. Like, you know, that's part of the sport, is doing as well as you can with your money. And why Force India were lauded for so long as the best pound for pound team was they were getting, you know, the aero points per pound.
Yeah, that's a fair enough comment too. You know, perhaps part of Ferrari's issue is that they're, organization is so wieldy and out of control now that they can't do things cheap anymore. Perhaps that's their problem.
Yes, but by the same token, Ferrari, Mercedes, Red Bull, and as we know from Carter, Renault at least, also employ a lot of people. If you say we are going to go from 175 to 100 or 125, what they will tell you is that my staff of 650 will now be 450 or 350, and I will have to not bring these people back, but fire them. And subsequent to that, and I think it's not an insignificant thing for people to understand that when we talk about a team like Haas or a team like Racing Point or any team that buys suspension bits, brake ducts, gearboxes. Well, that's a significant sunk cost in design staff to make that every year. Especially the exposed bits are complete aerodynamic parts, just like a front wing. So they do cost more to design. Absolutely.
Steve.
That's true that those large teams employ a lot of people. And yes, if suddenly the cost cap is brought down to, 125, whatever, they're going to have the ability to employ less people. But the other side of that is, unless we do this, we're going to lose maybe three or four teams out of Formula One. And that's probably a bigger whack than losing each of the big teams losing a few engineers.
Well, the original model was stepped down to allow the teams to work through their numbers, their employee numbers, and bring them down without getting rid of people. And I think what Ferrari is suggesting is that they're happy to come down, but there's going to be a basement for them where they have to start laying off people versus we don't want to lose teams off the grid. And that is a delicate balance and one that I think is, how can you even work it out when we don't even know when we're going racing again to a certain extent?
I understand that from the Ferrari point of view. I understand that from the big team's point of view. However, these are not normal times. These are not times that we planned for. And if F1 is facing an existential crisis where the choice is, and I'm not suggesting that this is the choice, but if the choice was the two big teams are going to have to lay off some staff so that four or five teams can survive, very easy for me to say because I'm not a Mercedes or Ferrari employee. But we could be looking at losing half the grid and maybe F1 completely disappearing. And if F1 disappears, everyone loses their job. So again, do email me, do tell me, or you can tweet us at MissApexF1 or at SpannersReady if that is a cold and callous approach. But these teams have grown to enormous, enormous sizes. Brackley has, 1,000 engineers? Compared to some teams who have a couple of hundred engineers. It's the same as a football team and one team playing with 15 players and one team playing with 8 players. So eventually, at some point, we were going to get to a sporting point where we realized that this wasn't good and it wasn't going to go on forever. And it could be the collapse of the global economy that is the catalyst for making F1 more of a sport and less of a franchise corporate operation.
Yeah, and if I could just dovetail on that, the model of the sport when Bernie ran it constantly saw the small teams changing hands and or leaving, and more teams than there were prize money spots for. So part of the model was we always wanted new money coming into the sport, trying to be successful. I think with Liberty taking it over, that has changed. They wanted the teams to have an ownership stake in the sport itself.
Franchise.
Exactly. But they're nowhere near being done with their plans when this happens. So it's all up in the air.
Let me defend myself from Tom Wheatley in the chat room who says, the socialist republic of Formula One. No, not at all. Like you said, there was a model where teams could come in and try and do well. But the fact is that the size of the top teams and the overall cost to get anywhere near the front of the grid has meant that those days Matt just described are completely over. You're not going to just get a team in F2 like in the movie Rush going, we'll just give F1 a go this season and see how it goes. You know, that isn't viable anymore. You need to be a huge corporation. You need to almost be a works team or someone like Gene Haas with all that racing pedigree to come in and try to do it. Because we've moved to this franchise and because we've got those absolutely ginormous powerhouse teams, moving those teams back down to sensible levels isn't some kind of F1 communist state. It's just a bit of common sense where we had a system, it was working for a certain amount of years, and it's just gone a bit too far. And something was going to have to happen to roll it back, or you're just going to get a four-car grid. Get off my soapbox and press buttons and things. Look, there we go. That's better. Well, news is all fine and well for a podcast to talk about, but really, we wouldn't have anything if it wasn't for our panel. And I'm going to speak to our two panelists, who are both experts in different ways. We all know old Aussie Steve there. When he's not wrestling crocodiles and putting them on barbecues, he's doing videos. But first, let's talk to Chris Stevens, who's been one of the longest-serving members of Missed Apex podcast. You were 12 years old when you made your debut here in the shed, Chris. And how far, I think that's accurate, how far we've come. And you are now 16 years old. No, you're an adult now. You're like, what, 24?
I'm 22.
22. That's so young. That's like pathetically young. That is pointlessly young. Like you don't even register to me as a human being.
Oh, so jealous.
Oh, I am absolutely jealous. Oh, to be young and beautiful again. But Chris, when we first met, you were a what Will Buxton would describe as a bedroom. You were trying to produce content in your bedroom of no particular pedigree. Is that fair to say? No particular, you know, your uncle wasn't head of Autosport. You didn't have great wealth behind you. You used to sort of just, you know, scrabble around in the dustbins, just hoping there would be some morsel for you to get through the day.
Yeah, so when I started, I was still at I was still in sixth form, or college.
Ooh, educated, whatever you want, fancy.
You know, yeah, there was a little bit of that. Working for this dead end website that I'd helped bring up from the earth. I plucked it out of the ground.
They're still running though, so I'm not gonna be too.
No,
harsh.
It's not.
Oh,
it's not.
Oh, okay.
It's not at all. It died like 2 weeks after I left.
But you were then going up to places who would pay you for an article, and you were obviously you had full time employment elsewhere. But you were honestly going about your trade, trying to be an F1 journalist. And this is why I sometimes get upset with people in F1 media who say, you know, wow, you should just stop working in other things and just get on a plane and follow F1 around. Because I watched you for years trying to follow motorsport around, and there is a monetary restriction unless you have really good connections. And we watched with pride as you went from writing the odd article for Formula Spy, for Formula E and Formula One, to then being accepted into the Autosport Academy. But you really had to graft to get there. And it's fair to say that the other princes that were there frowned upon you because you would turn up in handmade Hessian sacks instead of fine suits and clothing.
So after I left the dead end website to join Formula Spy, which was actually like a decent, very well regarded in Formula One, and started doing Formula E, and I was working at Top Man at the same time. All I wanted to do was work in motorsport media, and the whole point of working at Top Man was to pay for flights, pay for hotels. That's all it was, and to get me food during the rest of the time when I wasn't traveling. And it was that was about 3 or 4 years that I was doing that, while also doing some stuff with the Autosport Academy as well. Yeah,
hey, tell me about the Autosport Academy, because that has been over the years a breeding ground for young journalists. So how does that work? How do you get accepted to that? And you know, what kind of an advantage is it once you get there? You know, is that the start of the ladder, or is that just like a school?
So they advertise every once in a while. It's usually about every 6 months. I don't know how often it's happening now, but a few years ago, it was about every 6 months. They'd say, you know, if you want to join the academy, then send us your stuff. And I went for the interview, did the trials. You have to do like a certain number of tasks.
Tell me about the tasks. Don't skip past the tasks. What were the tasks you had to do?
So there was a Q&A, which was basically to assess your knowledge of motorsport and how well you can construct an argument.
And
so
after you failed those two?
I did pretty well in those, I think. And then so they invited me in to the office where we did some group trials, stuff where we did like, you know, group work. But then there were also other things like test of styles. So, you know, they give us a bit of copy and we point out the mistakes and stuff like that. How you do like a race report. So they showed us an Australian Formula Ford 1600 race from Bathurst, and like, right,
nice,
write a report on that for .com, which would never happen, but it's the the point of the task. And they seem to like me. So I got accepted. And then after that, it becomes, yeah, like a school where you are taught the best way to go about sort of motorsport journalism. And there were some interesting other things in there as well, like there were some PR lessons every once in a while and other things that you could apply in a motorsport way. So it was the best thing about it, though, is that it just becomes like a seal of approval. So when I was going about the paddock in Formula E, it was like, oh, yeah, and by the way, I'm also part of the Autosport Academy. And suddenly they go, okay.
Yeah, no, I've had very similar experiences where, you know, certain credentials mean that they might not say yes, but at least they tell you that, at least they take the time to tell you to sod off, and you go, oh yeah, that's further up the ladder than just being ignored. That's good.
But they remember you, and that's the important thing.
They remember telling you to sod off. Yeah. So you launch out of the Autosport Academy. And actually, Chris, you know, incredibly proud of how far you got. You didn't end up becoming basically Chris Medland or Will Buxton, but you plied an honest trade doing 750 Motor Club, where I know you made really good relationships there, which is the hallmark of a great journalist, and you're still friends with some of the people there, and then went all the way to Formula E in the paddock as well.
Yeah, so not with Autosport, I should point out. I bet Alex and Scott would be very upset if I were to say I was associated with them at the time. But I was doing Formula E stuff with Formula Spy, trying to do independently, applying everything that I'd learned with Autosport and from the 750 Motor Club into the international scene. And I could feel the massive difference between the first year when I was there against the 2 years that I did while I was in the academy.
Okay, so tell me about that, because one of the, here at Mist Apex, we've been chasing accreditation forever with very limited success. We are now getting to the point, by the way, where they do tell us to politely sod off, but in very nicely worded emails, and you may see some Mist Apex representation in the next couple of years. It's something we're definitely not giving up on. But I would not send myself, because I, as much as I would love to be in the paddock, the thought of like going up to these drivers and going, hi, I'm from the internet, can you tell me some things, terrifies me. You know, how did that feel the first time in the Formula E paddock with drivers who are household names?
So the first time was, there was like a bit of a starstruck thing. And I still do get that sometimes, because you forget, and then suddenly you remember, like, God damn, I'm dealing with like superstars here. And then, or if the, when Villeneuve joined Formula E as well, there was like a big like, whoa, okay. And then you do like a really good interview with someone who's like a massive name, like when Stoffel Van Dorn joined Formula E. So weird with Stoffel. So I just
Stoff, as you call him,
Stoffel. When he joined, so it was a testing in Valencia pre-season, and I thought, I just need to exude confidence. So just walked into the garage and just said, hi, Stoffel. Sorry to, you know, interrupt.
Or not Mr. Van Dorn.
No, Stoffel. Or first name him. Just introduced myself and said, you know, have you got 5 minutes for a quick chat? And you got to just do the introduction and get it out the way.
And do it. And so once you did a few seasons, didn't you, in the Formula E paddock?
I did 3.5 seasons.
So by the end, it really was Felipe, baby, Stoffel Waffle. Yeah. JV, how's it going? How's the kids?
So, I would ask Lucas about his son. Yeah. Leonardo. Jeff doesn't have any kids, but I would ask the drivers. Seb's got two kids. So I'd ask him about them as well. You have just casual conversation. That's part of building the relationship as well. It's just having casual and, frank, off the record, you know, conversations.
So one of the things I have noticed is that certain drivers tend to be a bit more shy, particularly if they don't recognize you as well.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, in your career, like, at what point did you cross over that boundary and could get actual conversations out of them?
So the first round is always going to be tough. The first round, you always have to just accept, look, they don't know me. So why should they tell me anything, really? It's when you start appearing at multiple races, they see your face more and more, you just got to try and talk to as many people as you can, as many opportunities as possible, making the connections with the PRs as well, because they're the ones who'll end up telling the driver, you know, oh, this guy's a regular, this guy's important, and we want to, you know, say something good for him or something like that. But it's just about, yeah, showing your face as much as possible.
In the chat room, let's see, Martin Van Kahn says, starstruck? I don't get that. They're just humans. And that is absolutely true. They all poop and wee, and they all put trousers on one leg at a time. But like when I've met my heroes, for example, podcast hero of mine, best ever podcast in the world, Dr. Stephen Novella from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I saw him in a conference in Manchester, and I was like, that's him. I'm going to stroll up to him and tell him I think he's brilliant. I got to within 2 meters and went, no, I'm not doing that. That's Dr. Stephen Novella off of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
So that is something you really do have to bear in mind. These people, they're just, you know, people. Treat them like people and not like, you know, with the eyes like, ah. But if I were to like compare Stoffel to when I first met Jeff, that's two ends of the extreme. Because with Stoffel, it was just very casual and he was very accommodating. Jeff, especially when he first arrived in Formula E, because he was not in a good place. He was angry as hell because he'd been ditched by Red Bull and he was forced out of Formula One. Now he had to drive in this rubbish electric series.
I'm glad you admit it, finally. Loved. Oh, okay.
No, he ultimately loved it as soon as he left. Because at the time as well, he just signed for a team that didn't want him there. And as soon as he joined Tachita, it was like Jeb was reborn. But when I first met him, he was still at Andretti. And so I would just was in London and I said, hi, Jeff, how are you? Have you got 5 minutes? And it was just no. And he walked off. They're like, oh, wow. Okay, that could have gone worse. But
hey, you don't ask, you don't get. Chris, we could talk to you all evening. Next time you're on, I want part two of the story moving into PR and you become the gamekeeper, not the hunter. Is that an accurate way to put it, isn't it?
Maybe.
Okay, we'll have more of that later, but I do want to make sure we speak to Steve as well today. You're listening to Missed Apex Podcast. That's right. I'm adopting the radio technique of reminding you what you're listening to. That's right. I've insulted your intelligence. Now I'm going to ask for support. www.patreon.com/missedapex is how we fund this podcast and keep it going. I cannot believe that during the pandemic, during the lockdown, when it's been 6 months since a Formula One race, there are still listeners out there who, A, Matt, continue to support us and have not left in droves, which I assumed they would, which is why we can be increasingly confident of still doing this. But people have been signing up, not at the rate that they would have done had we had races and Grand Prix, but people are still saying, I see that's how you're funded. I value what you're doing. And they're still signing up for Patreon. And I have been happiness sticking with that.
I cannot take away a more happy message in this time that we have managed to put something together and create a community that people wish to belong to. I had no idea we could be this successful at it. And I'm grateful that people have taken it to be what we always wanted it to be and are continuing to support it. I see Daniel Longworth saying, my girlfriend was your 500th Patreon. She was very upset at not being shouted. Well, consider this a shout, my friend.
Tell us her name so we don't just say of Daniel. Thank you for your support. The 500th patron was a real big milestone for us, Matt. We're an incredibly ambitious project, which we shouldn't be because we are basically scum, Matt. I don't know who do we think we are trying to make a thing of this. But the more we're supported, the more we grow, the more we can become established within F1 and start to do things, significant things, not because we're brilliant, but because we can bring on board people who are brilliant, frankly, Matt. That's been our tactic, hasn't it? This whole time is,
yes,
we're curious fans. We like chatting to each other about F1 and we work hard to bring people who know stuff.
Absolutely. I think slipstreaming is a thoroughly accepted tactic in Formula One, and that is entirely our model.
patreon.com/missedapex. Thank you so much for your support. Steve Amy from Australia land. You are You are the reason we have a YouTube presence. Without you, if you were to slip and fall in the shower, Steve, which is something at your age that I am constantly scared of, if you were to slip and fall, we would not have this video production. I literally cannot recreate what you do. And thank goodness you've got your Australian background now, because the sight of Chris's bedroom was giving me PTSD as your background. No, don't do it. No, don't do it more. I've just said, now I'm sweating like every visitor to Chris's bedroom failed to do. You are, though, a professional video guy. Like, you know, there's pictures of you in the 70s with crazy long hair in boob tubes doing stop motion animation. I may have made up the boob tubes. I don't know. But, you know, you've got a very video mind. You go out and do live stuff. You go and do like adverts and TV productions and things like that. So you understand camera angles and camera shots. So this is why when we've been doing the iRacing and you have been being our virtual TV director, it just looks amazing, Steve. Bradley Philpott would not shut up the next day going, oh my God, Steve's made it look like it's telly. Obviously iRacing takes a big credit for that, but your understanding of the different shots and what makes for good viewing have been brilliant. So my first question to you is, you know, how much is that part of your desire to have, you know, always been a motorsport video guy? And you go, oh yes, now I get to use my skills in a motorsport arena.
Oh, yes, part of that. I've, you know, been directing television stuff, including sport, for a long time, since the early 70s. It wasn't till the late 70s that I got into car racing. But once I got into car racing, yes, I was itching to get my hands, you know, on a let's go cover some car racing job. And it didn't really ever happen until I did lots of football and basketball and stuff like that. But the iRacing is given me a chance to, you know, go and pursue that a bit. And I get a huge kick out of trying to put together a quality kind of coverage, given that, you know, the people we're competing with are, you know, NASCAR, Formula One, Indy, those sorts of things. And they have big resources and they have contacts into all of the gaming companies and that sort of thing. So they get, you know, some easy access. We get none of that. So, you know, our task is put together a professional quality coverage without those kind of resources. Now, that happens because we have a brilliant team of people. It's not me. I do one part of it. We have Chris Squared, who are our brilliant commentary team.
And, two people, you know, called
really,
Chris.
Top of their game. And we have our iRacing administrators, Sam and Richard, who work really tirelessly hard to put it together and get the drivers on side and to make certain that they all run liveries we can and numbers that are consistent. And then there's Ian Erasmus, Bubbly Chunks, who does a lot of our car design. So that whole team of people, and of course yourself and Matt, and those people work as a team, and it is a brilliant thing for me to see this team come together and work. Now, I'm into teams. Whenever I'm out directing commercials and things like that, I'm putting together different teams all the time. Each crew is a different team. So that whole team building thing is something I'm very au fait with. And to see it being done at long distance, you know, from across the world,
yeah,
all the people together, is just, it blows my mind.
Now, it's not without its, you know, its hurdles. Kind of saying it's gone all smooth sailing and we haven't fallen out at least 1,000 times. But yeah, internationally collaborating with a team of willing volunteers to make that production has been very rewarding. But you know, we'll establish that we're using iRacing as our platform. And I think if you go and check out what we've done at Mist Apex Motorsport on YouTube, it should be there. Type Mist Apex Motorsport. Are they publicly now listed, the latest rounds?
The four races from last Friday are up there.
But now, particularly so race one, which I've watched, which was a great battle between our own Bradley Philpott and David Hatton, looked like legit TV coverage. And I think we've compared favorably to the organizations that you've said with the big budgets. Obviously, we can't compare with the driver names. So it's only if you're really into Mist Apex or competing, then yeah, you're going to get a kick out of watching it. But I would recommend at least going and checking out what Steve has done, and we're going to put a highlights package together. Really interesting with iRacing, though, is although anybody, probably literally anybody, could go and be a watcher for an iRace and put it on a video encoding software, like, you made the whole production. Like, you had video guides from Brad. You had, like, bumpers. You suddenly, like, in the morning, I woke up to you going, here's a voiceover script. Say things, monkey. And I went into the studio and recorded it. And then I was as surprised as anyone when the live stream started. And it was like, oh, there's me speaking with all these video breaks and stuff. Like, how important to you was that opening and that production and building a story?
That's really important. I mean, putting the package together so that it looks professional. That's how you make it look professional, by putting that kind of content into it. Then Chris doing his research into the track that we're on, so that we can pull up a track map and he can talk about why they're named, you know, the corners are named like they are. For sports coverage, there's kind of two ways you can, two kind of approaches to it. One is kind of the journalistic approach, and that is we will just cover the action. We'll make certain that, you know, the leaders get covered. If someone crashes down the back, we'll cut to that. And that's kind of a journalistic approach. For me, it's more important that we take a slightly dramatic approach, and that is that we build engagement with the audience, and we try and tell a really compelling narrative. Now, that is looking for where the competition is going on in the field, and I rely on Chris Squared for that, because they're looking at that sort of thing. And if they say, hey, such and such is having a great battle down the back with whoever, then I can jump to that and we can cover it. So building this kind of narrative is important, because that's the way that you get viewers involved. I mean, it's also partly the way we use camera angles, and I tend to use them slightly differently than a normal live coverage.
Okay,
and that's
Tell me why.
I use them slightly differently because I want to build this drama and narrative. Secondly, because I can. iRacing has a couple of wonderful things. That is, they have chase cameras. And tracking cameras that follow the cars, which I think are fantastically dramatic. I've had a few drivers from our iRacing fraternity say, oh, but it's not realistic. Well, I'm here to say that if Liberty could figure out how to configure a chase cam to follow a car, I mean, it's really a drone, a high-speed drone shot. If they could figure out how practically to do that, they would be pushing the Jesus out of it, and they would be publicizing it as a huge innovation in sports coverage. They can't do it, so for once we have the lead on them.
Matt.
Right. So Spanners asks the why, and I love that. But you know me, I'm definitely asking the how. How do you use these cameras differently to tell your story compared to, let's say, a standard Formula One broadcast? Like, what are you doing differently? And I need to tell you that Mark Greenhow and Eric, both in the chat, have shouted you out for just the amazing production values you've brought to this project.
Thank you, guys. How I use them differently is if there is a battle going on, And two drivers are, you know, really pushing each other, like Brad and David Hatton were last weekend, then I'm watching for them coming to the obvious overtaking points. And as they're coming to the overtaking points, I am likely to go through this kind of sequence. Cut to an onboard camera from the roll hoop or in the cockpit of the driver behind, so that we can see him coming up on the car in front. As he pulls out to go around the car, I will cut to a wider chase shot so that we can sit tracking with the two cars, so that we can see him pull out and begin to go around the car. Then I'll cut to a trackside shot as they finish the corner. As they come out of the corner and go away, I'll come out to a trackside car, still pretty close on the car. And by doing that, I'm bringing the viewer into the kind of world of the driver, what the driver is trying to do, and showing them that those chase cameras show the actual argy-bargy through the corner much, much better than just a trackside shot by itself, where you know, in a wider shot, you see the cars come around the corner and one overtakes the other. So I'm trying to drop the viewers into the world of the driver and to get that kind of sense of competition, of adrenaline, at living on the edge. And that's part of that, you know, compelling narrative that I'm trying to build rather than just point a camera at a car.
And you built it, you know, very well. We are very similar with that, with the coverage. When I was commentating on karting, had I been a better kart commentator, I would be like Crofty or Jack Nicholls with like supreme accuracy. But a lot of the time, as a club level commentator, Chris Stevens, you can relate to this. You get dropped in, you don't know any of the people, you don't know the colours. And the one thing I've said to you with the iRacing commentary, the only note I've given you because you're fantastic, is actually don't. This is not great, but like, don't worry too much about the details. Concentrate on the story you can see. Don't worry about what you can't, because there's so much you can't know.
No, because the problem is, I mean, we had 41 cars in the iRacing thing, and at the karting, we had
16.
What, 60. Yeah, so you 16, can't know 16, yeah. Everyone. And at least with the iRacing, I was able to do a lot of research, especially in terms of like the spotter's guide. So Steve did a fantastic job putting together all the liveries and telling me who was who so that I could research that beforehand. But I do also just want to say, like, thanks to everyone who has taken the time to say how much they enjoyed my commentary and Catman's as well. Actually, it really means a lot.
If you want to get involved in the next round of the Myst Apex iRacing, we are going to be racing on Thursday, the 23rd of April at the Silverstone National Circuit. There is tough competition for places, but if you are interested, get in touch with me, spannersready@gmail.com, and have iRacing as the subject line. If you can't get a place, fear not, we will add you to the registry, and I am arguing with Steve as we speak about opening up the grid for rounds 3 and 4.
Just real quick, because it's coming up in the chat room again and again. If you want to see these amazing videos Steve is talking about, you must search for Myst Apex Motorsports on YouTube. And if you feel like it, even subscribe.
Let's bring this back to F1, Steve. I've got some questions. So obviously you watch the F1 from a director's eye. Let's start with Darren, who is a patron. Thank you very much for your support. Darren, he's got three questions for you. And I love that he's used my numbering system. So question one, question two, and question three is an emoji. Good, correct. Why, when the sport is time limited, do we get so many shots of crowds and flags rather than racing? Is there a technical reason for this? Is it waffle or is it artistic? And just to add to that, there was a comment in the chat room from Lairhound who said TV cameras are often focused specifically on sponsor banners, and they've got that restriction as well. So let's start with the crowd shot, Steve. Is that just classic filler?
I think what they're trying to do is to give some sense to the viewer at home that it's a big event with lots of people there and it's exciting to sit at the side of the track and watch the racing. That's part of them promoting the event so that when the event turns up in your city, you'll want to go along and watch it. Part of it is just to break away a little bit from showing a track. You know, that's what you see for about 85% of any race coverage is cars going around a track. So I think they're just trying to break it up. I do agree with Darren that there is sometimes too much of it. And I can only assume that they may have a technical glitch or something like that, that they're using that shot to, you know, cover up. They have so many cameras and resources that, you know, to cut to a wide shot senselessly, you know, of a crowd just to cover up another camera shot repositioning or whatever is a bit weird. You'd reckon you cut to another shot where there's some action going on, since that's what the name of the game is. But I don't think it's filler. It's certainly not artistic, I don't think. In that kind of world, there's not a lot of artistic going on. Remember that
The direction
team... Sorry.
That's scathing, Steve. There's not a lot of artisticness going on.
No, there's not a lot for that. I mean, there's a lot of pressure from Liberty to make certain that all the teams get a bit of coverage, that all the major sponsors get a little bit of coverage for their signage too, because after all, that's what they sell, you know, it's what they're buying when the sponsors pay their money. The structure for a crew directing, following a Formula One race is pretty complex. In terms of direction, you've got the team that are responsible for just covering the race action. That is an online director, and he's working with the cameras and the cameramen to make certain that the cars are followed. On top of that, you have another team, a presentation team, whose sole job is to make certain that the appropriate graphics are up on screen at the right time in terms of timing, in terms of sponsors and all that sort of stuff, the AWS logos and they also have the responsibility of playing in the replays and they will line them up and put them in. And yes, sometimes they're very slow at putting them in. Yeah, the replays, you know, that's one of my big bugbears.
Is it?
If some exciting on track action happens, we should be able to see a replay 5 or 6 seconds later, not 25 seconds later when we've gone on three corners and we're now thinking about other things. Now, on top of those two layers, you will then have the overall producer or showrunner who will be saying just generalize things to the other two teams, like, we haven't seen any coverage of Haas down the back for a long time. Give us a couple of shots so that Gene doesn't come around and chew my leg off.
Fair enough, Steve.
So those three levels work together in order to bring the coverage to us.
It was a very popular theme, this one, with the crowd. So I'm glad you've addressed that. I mean, Brendan on Twitter, thank you, by the way, to everyone who responded at Miss Apex F1. What's the obsession with the crowds and the garage shots during battles? Is it a contractual requirement? And then he goes on to a point which Darren also said in our Slack group. Why not use the 70s tech of split screen when, for example, one driver is crossing the line and there's another battle going on? Darren said, is there a technical reason why F1 coverage doesn't use picture-in-picture, including in replays?
I don't think there's any technical reason why they don't, and I'm damned if I know why they don't. They use that technique very successfully with the Aussie supercars, and it is a brilliant way to be able to keep track of the on-track action while you're seeing a replay, and it would be very simple to set up. So, guys, I'll put my hands in the air. As far as I can see, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be doing that.
Right. Stuart Neal thinks we might need to outbid Sky for the next contract, but I believe all the TV ops come out of Biggin Hill and Formula One directly, so it wouldn't be as useful as you might think. I just want to get one quick question into Steve. Of the eras of TV, of Formula One TV that you've watched, do you have a favorite, not for the racing, not for the personalities, but just flat out for the best coverage?
Yeah, now. We have the technology. We have digital systems that allow us to have, you know, really interesting and deep data streams and show us all sorts of interesting data. Stuff.
I'm just translating so everyone will understand. No one says data.
Well, for you people in the Northern Hemisphere, yeah, okay. And we have much better cameras. The quality is certainly superior. We have many more of them. We have helicopters and blimps and drones and all of that stuff. So in terms of, you know, bringing a really interesting coverage to the sport, you can't beat today.
We have one more question that I want to give you from the Slack group, Steve, and then we'll wrap up today. And I'll tell you what, as so often happens with off-season content, you think, oh, what are we going to talk about this week? There's no news. There's no sport. You pull on a thread. And I now know I want to speak to Chris Moore about public relations and the way the drivers interact with the press and how they release all their promos. And Chris has already given us a glimpse. Chris has never told us anything. He's not told us anything that we're not supposed to know ever. He's very professional. But honestly, he's told us some really good stories. And now, Steve, I want to pull on so many of these strings of broadcast production. So we've certainly got more to talk about during the extended off season. I'm not even calling it lockdown. Don't even call it a lockdown. Call it an extended off season. Steve, Anders is making you the supreme director of the F1 live feed. Thank you, Anders, for your question. How would you manage it? Lots of different TV licenses, and way too often the key action is missed in real time. And as he points out, replays come in late. What few changes would you make to the F1 broadcast? We're giving you all the benefit of none of the problems they've got. This is pure wish list fantasy from an artsy video director point of view. Change what you want.
OK,
Okay, the first thing I'd do is develop high-speed drones that were able to track cars so that we had chase shots in real life. That would really, you know, up the game a lot. I agree with Anders that replays need to be much more immediate while people still have it in their brain and the adrenaline is still kind of running from the viewer's point of view. Oh, boy, was that a close call or he ran into the barrier? I would definitely try and make those faster. The way that the coverage gets to everybody around the world is it comes out of one central transmitter. All the camera angles at any race anywhere are sent via internet to England before they go anywhere else. There in England, there is a very large media centre in the south of England, which I think the media centre is still actually owned by Burnie, but the actual building and equipment, I think it's still owned by Burnie. Anyway, there they have a broadcast team, and that's where the camera director is located. He's talking to the cameraman. Remember, some of the cameras are also robot remote control heads these days that are operated by guys in England.
No,
they still have some live cameras.
So well, there's some trackside cams that are like virtually controlled.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they're on hotheads, and guys sit like, you know, like drone pilots in those, you know, movies that show them dropping bombs on people.
That's kind of ruined it a bit for me. There are still
some cameramen there, but why put a cameraman on a camera right in a dangerous position right close to the track when you can put it on a hothead and have some guy sit away from the track? True. And why pay for him to travel to Australia if we can do it from south of England? So those things happen. It goes through, it's at Biggin Hill in where is Biggin Hill? In Suffolk, maybe?
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway.
In the green bit.
It goes, okay, from out of Biggin Hill comes the generic international feed that is fed to each country. Sky gets the same feed, and then and so does Germany, and so does the Americans and the Australians down here. And then we put in our own individual bits and pieces. Sky cut into their camera shots, you know, showing their guys walking down the pit lane and doing their bits. But by and large, what they're doing is taking the international feed and customizing it. Some countries customize it more than others. Some, like Australia, don't customize it at all. They just take the international feed during the races and that's it.
Ah, so they don't have to take, when they say world feed, that's the choice that the central person in Biggin Hill, which by the way is in that there London, sort of, it's near the blue squiggle at the bottom. But they can also say, well, actually the world feed is currently following, I was going to say Michael Schumacher because I was watching 1997 season finale at Jerez earlier today. But say they're following Lewis Hamilton, but in Belgium, they want to see what Van Dorn or whatever is doing.
No, they can't do that. If I misled you. No, they are stuck with, in terms of the track action, they're stuck with whatever is coming out of Biggin Hill. They can put shots of, you know, Martin Brundle standing by the track commentating on it. If that's what they want, they use their own camera.
But they have to use their own. Got it. Okay. Yes. I'm with you. Steve, what else? One more thing. What would you change about the F1 coverage?
I'd be going for bucket loads more in-car kind of action. I mean, that's what, you know, they're the exciting angles. That's what people you take a big, you know, deep breath in when those kind of angles happen. So I'd be looking for more of that. Other than that, they do it pretty well. I mean, we all bitch and complain and there are some things we don't like, but they do it pretty well given the logistics they're trying to cover.
I was so excited when you said that. Have you seen visor cam and like glasses cam versus the fixed camera? You like that better, right? Because it's shaky.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think what they've got to do is put, you know, a good stabilizing system on those cameras so it's not quite as shaky as it is now. And make the angles of the cameras a little bit wider. The camera angles is another thing that is really important to the coverage of a race. And sometimes they choose the wrong angles. So, that's a long, involved thing. But, yeah, the visor cams are brilliant. And as soon as I get them sorted out, I love it. I want more of them.
A big thank you to everybody who's tuning in to Missed Apex podcast. I know not all of you are listening to it on a Monday morning. Some of you are catching up with it later. Thank you for continuing to download the show. Obviously, we took a hit in downloads initially, but it's starting to level off now. So you can consider yourselves part of the Lockdown Map crew. And actually, we've been performing really well in iTunes. We got up to 68 in the iTunes chart for UK sport, which is unbelievable for me. Obviously, you can put it down if you want to sport shutting down in general, and a lot of sports podcasts, you know, just deciding to hang up their boots for a little while. But you're not taking that away from us. 68 in the UK sports iTunes is absolutely massive for us. So thank you to everybody part of our community. Luke, Az, and Martin have signed up as patrons as we speak, as we're doing this show live. And thank you to everyone who comes and joins us in the live stream. Still in numbers today. I think we've had a peak of nearly 300 people tuning in and listening to our little shed show. Thank you for being part of our lives, and we hope we can be a small part of yours. Matt, this chat room, though, they don't half come up with some comments. Oh, yeah, that's right. Spanners be remembering comment of the week. I'm going to play the bumper. Comment now it's official. I remembered it, and it's happening in the show before the end credits. Whoop.
Well, I think we're going to have to start out with the fact that, I mean, even now, they're making me cut and paste comments. That our 500th Patreon was indeed Sydney Thompson. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Sydney.
And oh my goodness, you thought the show was long. Wait till you get to comment of the week, because man, they're making up for lost time. They were.
Matt, you don't have to read every comment. Right? Okay, so let's be clear. Comment of the week doesn't involve you just reading out the whole chat room from start to finish. You're supposed to pick the best comments, and then we pick a winner.
Yeah. I am
ignoring me.
I lost it. I'm frustrated because there were a lot of very, very funny comments this time around. And my favorite was Chris brought the Monaco IKEA room regarding his brand new background, but it's with a whole bunch of symbols and not quite spelled right, like things from my IKEA generally are. But I've lost the person who made that comment. So we will go with regarding Chris. DJ Opdam, is Chris homeless and living in Monaco now? Which I thought was mildly amusing. And Michael Diestelhoff, who really got in on the Steve segment, starting with is looking tasty, man.
What? No, move on. The hell?
Fine, I'll move on. He then went for, so for added drama, Steve is going to shout on the drivers, the iRacing drivers, come on, you slow bugger, get out the freaking way.
Okay, that's a little sweary.
That's a little sweary. DJ Opdam would very much like to know who is driving the Mist Apex car, first name, last name.
Nice one. And there's the Mist Apex car for the video viewers. There we go.
And Nathka said, I just noticed there's a spider on Steve's background and genuinely startled. So well done with your visual design there.
I mean, gosh, Australia is full of scary creatures. And the wildlife is pretty frightening as well.
it is indeed. And then finally, we get in with it. Williams, Philip, Williams should get sponsored by medical marijuana to help ease their back marker pain.
Oof. Okay.
Martin Dooley is in with Williams Renault. History shows that your ex-wife still isn't a good idea. Ask McLaren Honda.
Do you know what? I nearly said McLaren Honda instead of, it's so similar that I nearly said that.
Yeah, and then finally, Martin Dooley again with talking to Chris Fonseca. We clubbed together for Matt's meal when I was in Italy. Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate that. Surely we could afford a Williams sponsorship.
Maybe.
And finally, yeah. At the last second, regarding our iTunes rating,
most Will Crockett, ever.
68. Almost nice.
Almost nice. Guys, thank you so much for your comments and giving Matt such a headache when it comes to picking comment of the week. Earlier in the show, Steve called me hemispherist. I would like to deny that because I think Steve would agree we're friends and I've got a Southern Hemisphere friend, so I can't be hemispherist. Who is the winner of comment of the week, Matt?
Oh, it's a tough one, but I think I'm going to have to go with Will Crockett, 68. Almost nice.
I thought you were going to give us a new nomination. Just in, 17 more nominations, but congratulations, Will Crockett. You're the winner of
comment of the week.
All right, is that it? Because Evangelos has just said that you did say three final comments. Like, I wasn't dreaming that. You said final comment three times. In fact, oh, go on, what now?
It was different categories. We had the Chris category and the Williams category, and we had the Steve category. And besides which, Evelyn Coleman is in with Spanner's face when Matt keeps reading comments is why I'm here. So I had to read that one. You understand?
No, right. We've gone too far. And to quote Jean-Luc Picard, the line is here and no further. He was talking about Borg, but I'm talking about the relentless assault of comments. Thank you, chat room. Thank you to Steve Amy, Chris Stevens at Chris on Racing. I knew this one on Twitter. Matt at MattPT55. You can be my Facebook friend. Search for Richard Reddy on Facebook or follow me on Twitter at Spanners Reddy. Thank you so much for keeping us company. We'll see you next Sunday for Joe Saywood and Matthew Carter in the shed. Until then, be brave, because wounds heal, chicks dig scars, and glory lasts forever. This was Missed Apex. I feel like, Matt, you have taken the small license of comment of the week and you are increasingly expanding it until comment of the week is the whole show, and then you're the host of Welcome to Comment of the Week, and then I'm just like your sidekick making comments on your comments. And that's your plan, and don't think I haven't noticed.
I don't know what you're talking about. That was none whatsoever.
20-minute segment. It's a 20-minute comment of the week segment. Thank you very much. And there's Mark Greenough. There are four lights. That's true. There are four lights, or weren't there? I can't remember which way. Wait, you were. Oh, you know what? I'm pressing stop because all of that was stupid.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.